Hello, I'm John Mao. This is number 0499, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0499. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, science writer Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back, talking about Canada's upcoming project with NASA to help build and operate the Lunar Orbiting Platform Gateway.
Canada is going to be an integral partner in developing the Gateway Lunar Station, in much the same way as we saw with the International Space Station in orbit around the Earth. Canada was very pivotal in the construction of the station and then the maintenance, the ongoing maintenance. So we're going to see the next generation of Canada arm, which was so familiar on the, of course, the space shuttle fleet back in the 80s and 90s. And then we saw the same thing happen on the International Space Station.
David Allensworth, the writer and director of the film Soul to Keep. It's a horror flick with a few twists.
We've stepped it up by adding a deaf character in the ensemble cast who signs with everybody, and everybody on screen signs back with her. So it really shows the inclusive nature that can be reflected in today's society. As far as storytelling is concerned, we step it up a notch because there's some psychological elements at play that I can't reveal entirely, but that there are some elements that come into play late in the story that you say, oh, I can't believe that, you know, and it's one of those kind of clever films. So you stick around for it and you'll be rewarded.
Edward Torchy Smith is the author of Shooting the Breeze with Baby Boomer Stars. How did this book come to be?
My daughter was a TV producer and my son was a talent agent. And actually, I helped get my kids started in it. And many of my friends from Shaker Heights High School, not many, but a few actually, ended up in Hollywood. And I went out there and visited them and sort of had an in, so to speak, to get started. But I basically did this on my own and thought, well, you know, let me see if I can do this. And that's the first chapter of the book, is the story of how that all worked out and started with the Mouseketeers, actually.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0499, was John Mao, the manager for media services and the chief engineer at WLSL LP 92.7, the radio station at St. Leo University in Dade City, Florida. It's one of the many stations you can find the Stuff File program on weekly. As a matter of fact, the show airs there at 8 p.m. on Fridays. Thank you very much, John, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? An 11-year-old boy charged with shooting his father, an Indiana state trooper, was upset because his parents had confiscated his video games. The boy shot his father, Officer Matt Makowski, in the buttocks with the officer's .45 caliber duty weapon. Wow, so it is true. Raising preteens can be a pain in the ass. The boy got the gun from Makowski's locked police vehicle parked outside the family's home. Makowski later told police he kept his weapon locked in his vehicle because he did not want his kids to have access to it. Smart thinking. Police arrived at the family's home on reports of a shooting. The boy surrendered without incident. The boy later told police he wanted a PlayStation, an Xbox, and a computer, and that he was going to get these simple things or there would be a part two. Yee. Court documents say the boy has a history of behavior problems at school. The parents had recently taken his video games and removed them from the house. Oh, you know this isn't over yet. Junior here is a ticking time bomb. He says he's going to get these simple things or there's going to be a part two. Dad better not turn the other cheek. Oh, the things children will put their parents through, no matter what the ages of the kids will be. Case in point, 30-year-old Holly Ann Albert of Potomac, Maryland, demanded that her mother drive her to yoga class. The unnamed mother says she refused, and Holly, who is unemployed and still living with her, became irate, shouting insults, and, when she turned away, threw the house phone at her, hitting her in the head. The mother picked up the phone and dialed 911 for help. Responding officers found the woman had a blood-saturated shirt and her hair was matted down with blood, and Mom explained that Holly wanted to go to her yoga class for, quote, meditative purposes. Yeah. Holly has been charged with felony assault and faces up to 10 years in prison. I don't think Holly could ever take enough yoga classes to reach the meditative state she so desperately needs. Well, the long, harsh winter must be getting to folks in Muskego, Wisconsin. To wit, police were called to a home on February 22nd after a big teddy bear was reported to be at a neighbor's front door. As it turned out, the human-sized panda, not native to the Badger State, was a 48-year-old man who had been asked to check on the dogs and thought it would be funny to prank his neighbors through their security system. I knew my neighbors had cameras, and I thought I was going to make the ordinary extraordinary and dress up in the panda suit, the unnamed man told a local CBS affiliate. Apparently, he has also picked up his daughter at school and met her at the bus stop in the suit. Pandas are her favorite animal. Now, that's a dad who just has a sense of humor and enjoys a lot of fun. That's also a dad who, in many other neighborhoods in the U.S., would have been shot, stuffed, and mounted over the fireplace. Which brings us to our next story. It's time to check the Darwin file.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
Neighbors of 33-year-old Michael Presick of Zadechov, Czech Republic, were rightly concerned about the animals living on his property. In 2016, Presick bought a full-grown lion and 2 years later added a lioness for breeding purposes. He built enclosures for them, defying government regulations, and would not allow authorities onto his property to investigate. Well, this month, Presick's project had met a tragic end. He was discovered by his father in the lion's cage, mauled to death. The father said the cage had been locked from the inside. Police, who were called to the scene, killed the two lions in order to reach Presek's body. Presumably grasping for a silver lining, Zadechov Mayor Thomas Kukurik commented, "Today's incident will perhaps finally help to resolve this long-term problem." Oh, that's cold, dude. And so is Presek. What I'd like to know is why Presek would lock himself inside the cage with the lions. The mind really wanders on that one. What I do know is the tree of life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you.
Yes. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Recently, the Canadian government announced that Canada will become a partner in the Lunar Orbiting Platform Gateway, a facility that NASA envisions as both a proving ground for space technology and a precursor to an eventual human mission to Mars. To talk about this, we are joined once again by science writer Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy. Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, The True Science Behind the Starship Voyages. He joins us via Skype from somewhere on a beach in Florida. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Peter. It's so nice to join you. This is the only way.
Oh, you lie like a rug. I mean, you're lying right now because you're probably on a beach towel, but... I'll keep this quick because I know you're busy doing other things.
Yeah, I've got some tanning to do, but that's okay.
Exactly. Anyway, recently the Canadian government announced the idea that Canada was going to be involved in this lunar orbiting platform Gateway, and it seems like we're going to be involved much in the same way we were involved in other space exploration situations with something we're well known for, and that's the Canada arm.
Yeah, exactly. It's this is something that I think many, particularly Canadians, will be very familiar to, in that you know, Canada is going to be an integral partner in developing the Gateway lunar station, the orbiting station, in much the same way as we saw with the International Space Station in orbit around the Earth, where we were really pivotal. Canada was very pivotal in the construction of the station, and then the maintenance, the ongoing maintenance that we still see today, more than 20 years after the original components were set into orbit. So that really involves the robotics that are on that will be on the lunar gateway. So we're going to see the next generation of Canada arm, which was so familiar on the, of course, the space shuttle fleet back in the 80s and 90s, helping astronauts launch satellites, retrieve satellites, doing repairs on satellites, taking out research experiments from the cargo bay of the space shuttle. And then we saw the same thing happen on the International Space Station, where Canada was called upon to really develop the robotic arm system that was so pivotal in putting together the football field-sized orbiting laboratory around the Earth. And so with the Lunar Orbiter, we'll see Canada Arm 3. But this time, Peter, we're going to also see artificial intelligence being involved, where Canada has also shown leadership when it comes to space technology and the intersection with artificial intelligence. And that will come in the form of having the station, the Lunar Gateway, being able to be autonomous many times. So astronauts won't have to be on board the Lunar Gateway orbiting station for it to really function. So that's going to be these are really very vital components to the Lunar Gateway program.
And to make it clear to everyone, right now the International Space Station is in an orbit around the Earth. The Lunar Orbiting Platform Gateway, as the title suggests, will be orbiting the Moon.
Exactly, exactly. So, and it'll be a much smaller version of the International Space Station. So just to give you an idea, the International Space Station has somewhere over 1,300 cubic meters of space, livable space, whereas the Lunar Gateway outpost around the Moon will only be less than 70 cubic meters. Now that's okay, Peter, because the astronauts that'll be on the Lunar Gateway station won't be there for that long. You know, we're used to seeing, you know, on the ISS, folks stay for as long as 6 months at a time. On the Lunar Gateway program, we're talking probably no more than a week or so. You can think of it sort of as a waypoint, a way station between our two worlds, between Earth and the Moon. And so it's just a drop-off point, a resting stop, so to say, between the Earth and the Moon.
Now, when we talk about a lunar orbit, are we talking something that is a higher orbit or a lower orbit than, say, what the commander of the Apollo missions would be orbiting while two men were on the surface?
There's still a lot to be determined on exactly how. There's actually a debate going on in the space community of exactly the altitude. But the idea is really that it allows a platform for a quick jaunt onto the surface of the Moon from where the lunar gateway will actually be. So, you know, when you're talking about the Apollo missions, they were, you know, maybe a few hundred kilometers above the surface at most, really skimming the lunar surface. This is going to be at a much higher altitude, and this will really be sort of almost as an observational outpost of the overall the moon surface. But it will be close enough to really allow very quick sorties from the Lunar Gateway station above the moon down to surface. This will become especially important when we're starting construction on any lunar outpost on the surface of the moon, I should say.
Well, I was just about to ask, does this lunar orbiting platform gateway have a predetermined lifespan? In other words, is it there just to facilitate the idea of being up there while they build some sort of more permanent structure on the lunar surface? Or is it something that will always be around regardless of how much planning is built on the lunar surface?
I think it's fair to say that it will be a fairly permanent station. We've seen how useful it is to have a platform that's under microgravity or zero gravity with the ISS above the Earth. It's a really unique platform that allows construction that's much more allows a lot of cost savings to it. And it's also, in terms of science, it's very important to have a station like this, a way station, where you can have sort of like a quarantine area for any like surface samples coming, not just from the moon, but perhaps eventually from Mars that may be coming towards Earth. They may be quarantined initially on a lunar gateway outpost. So there's a lot of functions moving out for decades into the future. Even once lunar colonies are on the surface of the moon, there's a lot of function built into a lunar orbiting station like this.
Does one anticipate that there will be, for lack of a better term, direct flights to that particular lunar orbiting platform gateway, or would it be a two-step tier type thing going from the International Space Station to the lunar orbiting platform to the moon?
Well, I don't see the ISS really playing a part of that really as much. It'll probably be directly from the surface of the Earth to the lunar outpost, the gateway, and then from there going to the surface.
This particular news about the Canada Arm, or what's being known now as Canada Arm 3, there's a strong history with the Canadian Space Agency being involved in space exploration. How important was this, given the fact that nowadays it seems to be that space exploration is something that is more international in scope and that more countries are playing a bigger role in space exploration? Was it important for Canada to get this jump on this situation to continue being a strong member of the space community?
Well, definitely. I mean, if we look at the model of what's been done, you know, how Canada has done its space business, being taking part in major space initiatives when it comes to human space exploration, you know, the model that's been used is that we supply the robotics, and in return for our technology, we get a seat for our astronauts on board these missions. Now we're this is now, you know, looking into the future, we're talking deep space exploration, not just low or Earth orbit jaunts. We're talking going to the moon and, of course, eventually to Mars, asteroids perhaps. And, you know, the international space community, especially like if you look at NASA, they really look towards Canada and its legacy in space robotics and artificial intelligence, things like that, to leverage that in these international projects. And so it's important for Canada. It creates a very vibrant space industry within Canada. It allows Canada to maintain talent in-house, prevent brain drain, losing that talent in the space community, and it continues our leadership in the international realm of space exploration, and it allows us to really be at the forefront of where we're going next. Canada may not be launching its own rockets, but we are really quite a powerhouse when it comes to robotics, and it's, you could see that NASA really looks towards Canada for its knowledge in robotics, and in return we get a seat for our astronauts. So I don't see any if I look to the future, Peter, I see a very bright future for Canada in human space exploration, seeing Canadian astronauts not just on the Gateway project, but on the surface of the moon, building lunar stations on the surface and going on to Mars. I see this as being a major stepping stone for Canadians going on to the red planet eventually.
Mm. Always fascinating to have you on the program, sir. I bet you wish you had the Canada arm right now to apply sunscreen.
Yeah, well, that would make life a little easier, definitely.
Enjoy your time on the beach, sir. Thanks once again for being on the program with us.
Always a pleasure, Peter. Clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy and author of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0499, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the writer and director of the movie Soul to Keep, plus Edward Torchy Smith, author of Shooting the Breeze with Baby Boomer Stars. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and also is heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated on my part. Please, go ahead and do that. Thank you. Anyway, let's get back to the stuff. 33-year-old Adolph Thornton, a rapper who goes by the handle Young Dolph, was having lunch at a Cracker Barrel in Fairburn, Georgia. His car in the parking lot, described as a custom camouflage Mercedes-Benz SUV, was burgled while he ate. Thornton claims the thieves got away with a $230,000 watch, an $85,000 watch, a $24,000 pair of sunglasses, and other items, including a pistol, with a total value of near $500,000. Okay, let's just go out on a limb and say that perhaps it's not an accurate statement to call his car a custom camouflage Mercedes-Benz SUV, because clearly this thing was easy to spot. And by the way, if you're leaving nearly $500,000 worth of stuff in your car, perhaps it's time to rethink the idea of where you should park. Yeah. And in the category of unnecessarily calling attention to your criminal self, 36-year-old Trinidad J. Garcia of Forest Lake, Minnesota, wins the gold. On March the 1st, as Garcia motored his BMW North on snow-slick I-35, police say he fired a stolen gun without provocation into the passenger door of a pickup truck that was passing him on the left. He then veered into the median ditch. Lucky for him, a state trooper was close by and stopped. Garcia, who had stuffed the loaded gun in his front pocket, was arrested. In his car, officers found a shoebox with $11,481 in cash. He was charged with second-degree assault, drive-by shooting, and being a felon in possession of a firearm. By the way, when asked for his destination, Garcia said he was headed to Canada. Garcia's criminal history in Minnesota includes a conviction for third-degree assault and numerous convictions for driving after having his license revoked. Because car stories like these, they always have a revoked license, don't they? Way to keep a low profile, pal. He seems like the kind of guy who draws unwanted attention to himself. I'm guessing this will be a habit he'll have to break in prison, or someone will break it for him. Okay, do you ever read the fine print in any of your contracts? Maybe you should. A Florida travel insurance company has awarded a Georgia high school teacher $10,000 for reading the fine print in a policy she recently purchased. A Square Mouth statement says Donalyn Andrews claimed the prize 23 hours after the contest began. The St. Petersburg-based company says it launched the secret contest February 11th. Buried in the fine print was a promise of $10,000 for the first person to send an email to a specific address. Besides the $10,000 for Andrews, Square Mouth says it's giving another $10,000 to a children's literacy charity, plus $5,000 each to the two schools where Andrews teaches consumer economics. Andrews says she applied for retirement a week before winning the contest. The prize will fund a trip to Scotland with her husband to celebrate their 35th wedding anniversary. Now that's just a feel-good story. And I'm sure it's making you scurry over to your file cabinets to take a look at any and all contracts you might have. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Jackson, Michigan man on his way to breakfast with friends went to the hospital instead after unintentionally shooting himself in the parking lot. Police and rescue crews were called at about 9:50 a.m. for a report of a gunshot victim. The 30-year-old man was with his girlfriend and a friend parking on their way to eat at the restaurant when he got out of the car, went to holster his handgun, and it went off, striking him in his left thigh. The man called 911 and admitted to unintentionally shooting himself. The gun was legally owned by the man, and he had a valid concealed carry permit with him at the scene. The man was taken to hospital. His injuries were not life-threatening. The shooting was ruled accidental. You know, when you get shot in the leg, it makes it difficult to walk on the injured limb, so you might have to jump around on one leg before help can show up. What's that called when you do that? I can't remember right now. Oh, and I forgot to mention the name of the restaurant where they were going. IHOP. Anyway, let's get to the next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? David Allensworth is the writer and director of the horror thriller film called Soul to Keep. The film stars Sandra May Frank, a deaf actress and the star of Broadway's Spring Awakening. David joins us via Skype from New York. Hi, David.
Hello. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. There seems to be a renaissance of horror films, and by that I mean traditional horror films, where it's more psychological and thought process as opposed to the simple slasher films that were popular a while ago. Would you say this movie, your film, Soul to Keep, is following in that genre?
Yeah, it does. It does. We bring a whole new level to the traditional format of storytelling. We have a format that we have seen before, where, you know, friends show up in a single location, something goes wrong, and, you know, evil ensues. And but we've stepped it up by adding a deaf character in the ensemble cast who signs with everybody, and everybody on screen signs back with her. So it really shows the inclusive nature that that can be reflected in today's society. And then as far as storytelling is concerned, we step it up a notch because there's some psychological elements at play that I can't reveal entirely, but that there is some elements that come in to play late in the story that you say, oh, I can't believe that, you know, and it's one of those kind of clever films. So you stick around for it and you'll be rewarded.
As a director, how does it complicate or change your directing style or situation when you're dealing with a lead actress who is deaf?
That's a good question. It certainly was a new element that we all had to deal with, but we handled it very carefully and authentically. It was, you know, we had to make sure that there were interpreters on set, that we had what's called an ASL master, American Sign Language master, who helps to ensure that the rest of the cast who's signing with her whenever she's on screen is signing correctly and naturally. And whenever we did it wrong, we had to do a take again. And so that did, you know, slow down the process a little bit, but it was worth it because you started to understand a whole nother language. You started to feel the passion and the nuances of speaking American Sign Language.
Tell us about the story of Soul to Keep.
Soul to Keep is a horror thriller about Beelzebub, who is an ancient demon. I think a lot of our horror fans know who Beelzebub is, a kind of a gluttonous soul. And he's hell-bent on possessing and consuming souls. And in this story, ends up preying on siblings, a pair of siblings, and their millennial friends at their inherited rundown country house.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so that, you know, friends show up and say, hey, we're going to take over this house, it's party, and they do. They get drunk and high, and then one of them, due to a blackout that happens, goes down to the basement to check on the breaker and discovers a hidden room that was not there before. And it has a ritual room with all kinds of bloody, disgusting things that were going on down there, and they're all very curious. And one of them recognizes the setup and realizes that this was a, you know, demon conjuring room. And they think it's a great, fun idea, as drunk and high kids do, to just have fun and go for it. And it kind of goes wrong.
In addition to being the director, you are also the writer of this. Was it always your intention to have a character who was deaf, or was that something that came your way upon casting Sandra May Frank?
Actually, somewhere in the middle. The original script actually was a colleague of mine, a good friend of mine, who wrote a comedy version of this. It was called I Eat Your Soul, which is very fun. But I got a hold of it and felt like it had a really good nuance in there, but I wanted to really tell a scary story as opposed to just a funny one. And then as the rewrite was happening, I came up with the deaf character along that process. And then we went and cast it, looked for someone who could play that part. And it just so happened that Spring Awakening was just finishing up on Broadway. And I auditioned a lot of those fine actresses there. And Sandra was the one that popped out. She was amazing.
Coming up with the idea for the story, or this angle of the story, was it something that was just a plot device for you? Or do you have personal connections with someone or anyone who is deaf that made you think of this plot angle?
I love that question. It's actually both. The original feeling was more of a scare tactic. Oh, if you can't hear it, it's not like I'm reinventing the wheel, but I felt like I could really use that and play with sound, which I love to do, you know, in this film on and off. But as I started to introduce this idea, my co-writer, Eric Bram, his wife has significant hearing loss. And one of my producers, Matt Meyer, also has significant hearing loss. So it started to, no pun intended, ring true with, you know, our producing family, our creative family. And then as we got to set, we began to feel like this was so much more than just a scare tactic. This was something that felt like we're bringing something to the screen that you haven't seen before. You've seen deaf characters, but they're always about being deaf. This movie is a horror thriller with an ensemble cast, and one of them just happens to be deaf.
It seems like you like to think outside of the box when you're writing and directing. I believe you had a previous film which was done in three panels. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. It was called Hope's Portal. It was a short film. It won several awards along the, you know, the festival circuit, and it was a great experience to try a new idea of splitting the screen three ways with actions happening all at the same time. And leading to a certain location, and then, you know, there's a surprise there.
So are you someone who likes to think outside of the box as either a writer or director?
Yeah, of course. Yes, absolutely. That's like my MO. Almost everything I've written and all the future projects, they have this kind of twist to it that you didn't see coming, kind of a gotcha, kind of a sixth sense, kind of like one of those things where you're looking for it, you don't find it, and then when it comes, you're like, I need to see this again, you know, and I love that feeling.
It sounds like when you put together a movie, be it Hope's Portal or this one, Soul to Keep, you're challenging yourself. So in this particular movie, Soul to Keep, as a director and writer, through the process, what did you learn about either the process or yourself?
I learned that you have to hire the right people. Money is an object, and we're all, as independent filmmakers, don't have a lot. But it is worth it to get the right people, because the wrong crew on the set can ruin your production. It could cost days and days. And we had some of that on this set where we had some great talent. But then there was a few that was like really making it difficult for us. And looking back, I think I would pay attention to that. Or if somebody's not working out, you know, get that backup person in there right away, because this is going to be a problem throughout. And we rectified our situations on set, but that's something I definitely learned.
In the horror genre, what do you think are the things that every horror film needs to do to be successful?
There's the obvious where you say you have enough scares, or the give the feeling of tension and fright for that audience. But ultimately, you want to create a universe that the audience can relate to and get lost in. And then for me, I want to go beyond just this film. I want to imply that this world is much bigger than just this film, because you want the audience thinking about that. Could there be a second one? Could there be a whole series of these films? And in fact, yes, there can be for Soul to Keep.
The film is coming out on video on demand on April 2nd. Where can one find the film?
Pretty much anywhere you go on demand, you can find the film. You know, Comcast, Dish, you know, whatever it is you have. Also digitally, all of the transactional video on demand places like Google Play, Amazon, Xbox, iTunes, you name it, like all these, everything digital. We have a great distributor, and we are coming out on April 2nd for, you know, everything digital and on demand.
And there is a website, soultokeepmovie.com. I would assume that's a place people can find out more information about its availability and more about the film itself.
That's true. Soultokeepmovie.com. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Our handle is soultokeepmovie. So please follow us there so that we can keep you posted on everything that's coming up. We do have an event coming up in Cincinnati at Horror Hound, the Horror Hound Weekend, which is the largest horror convention in the United States. And we will be there. We are nominated for Best Feature, and we'll be joining the 30 to 40,000 plus, horror fans.
Congratulations on the film and continued success, David. I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you. You got it. Anytime. Talk soon.
David Allensworth, writer and director of the horror thriller film called Soul to Keep. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0499, and you'll find links to David's site, where you can find out more information about the film and its release dates. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. One thing I've learned after years of analyzing multi-million dollar legal verdicts and multi-billion dollar government budgets is this. Huge raw numbers mean virtually nothing by themselves. Unless they're put into context, it's impossible to understand the true significance of any number that ends in billion or trillion. For instance, the total cost of complying with all the federal regulations each year is estimated to be $1.9 trillion. But what does that really mean? Well, here's some perspective. When we look at the value of all the goods and services produced by every country around the world, only 7 countries have a GDP that exceeds the estimated cost of regulation in the United States. Let's be fair. That means it costs more for businesses, charities, and everyone else to comply with federal regulations than the value of everything created by Canada in 1 year. In other words, U.S. regulation is the 8th largest country in the world. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of Shooting the Breeze with Baby Boomer Stars. Plus, we do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on. And a few more Stuff File stories to share here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a Florida man who grabbed a McDonald's worker by the collar because he couldn't find a straw was sentenced to 60 days in jail. Oh, that couldn't be a very happy meal. A Pinellas County judge also ordered 40-year-old Daniel Willis Taylor to stay away from the restaurant and the workers he attacked in the incident, which was caught on video. Taylor was credited with the 58 days in jail he already served. He also must pay a $1,000 fine. Authorities say Taylor became irate when he couldn't find a straw on New Year's Eve. The video shows him standing at the counter, screaming at 20-year-old Yasmin James before grabbing and holding onto her shirt collar. She responded by hitting him several times. Taylor also kicked another worker while being escorted out. Like using a straw, this guy's life really sucks. Clearly, plastic straws are having an effect on his environment. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Edward Torchy Smith is the host of Baby Boomers Talk Radio and has interviewed countless celebrities. So naturally, he has put some of his best work in a book entitled Shooting the Breeze with Baby Boomer Stars. He joins us on the line right now from Cleveland. Hi, Edward.
Hi. Hey there. Hi there. Ho there. I'm stealing your line. I'm as happy as can be.
Do I?
T-O-R-C-H-Y-S-M-I-T-H.
Now, do I call you Edward or do I call you Torchy?
Oh, please call me Torchy. I got that from birth. I had bright red hair. The nurse brought me to my mother. She said, here's your little torch. I was registered in school with that name, and I'm 73 years old, never got rid of it.
Okay. So the book, Shooting the Breeze with Baby Boomer Stars, I mean, you and I have something in common. We've both written books that deal with that same type of genre, that group. Now, for me, it was a love of being a fan of these people. What was it for you that got you into this and got you to write this book?
I wanted to be one of them when I was a kid. And it's something I had always wanted to do and thought, well, you know, I'd love to talk to Jerry Mathers, love to talk to these people from the old days. And it turned out my daughter was a TV producer and my son was a talent agent. And actually, I helped get my kids started in it. And many of my friends from Shaker Heights High School, not many, but a few actually, ended up in Hollywood. And I went out there and visited them and sort of had an in, so to speak, to get started. But I basically did this on my own and thought, well, you know, let me see if I can do this. And that's the first chapter of the book is the story of how that all worked out and started with the Mouseketeers, actually. And, of course, the only celebrity I really know and knew well and still know well is Geraldo Rivera, who did the foreword of my book. And that's a long story in itself, and that's in the last chapter of my book also.
Now, in the names you just shared, with the exception of Geraldo Rivera, it seems like your initiation into this was, as you said, you wanted to be one of them. It seems to be you were talking to people who were primarily at the time child stars or around your age. Would that be correct?
Absolutely. That's where the baby boomers comes in. I was born in 1947. Baby boomers kind of start 1946, 1947. And if you remember, or if some of your audience can remember, we only had three stations back then. So if it was the Mickey Mouse Club or Rin Tin Tin or Donna Reed, whether they were talented or not, they were on there, and everybody talked about it at school. Today I have my granddaughter over, and for kids programs I go through, how about this one? How about this one? How about this one? How about this one? No, no. And I go through 12 things before she decides. So I'm sure they're not all on the same ball field that we were on. So that's a little bit how I got started. And it's just something I cherish. I'm proud of living in the past. I don't mind telling people that. That's my life. But I do have I shouldn't say that's my life, but I that's where I'd like to be.
I'm right there with you, right there with you. Now, one of the things we often hear, and again, I've had the opportunity to chat with many child stars as well, and mm-hmm. I find that there is a, shall we say, not necessarily a cliche, but a theory that all child stars have problems. And I just don't find that to be the case. Did you find that the same? I mean, I can name child stars who had problems, but they're not in the majority. Right.
I wouldn't say there's a majority either. I hold this to be what as my theory, and many of the child stars have told me, if their parents were good, and they had a good relationship with their parents and had a backup plan, and their parents had a backup plan, they did fine. If they were under pressure to be the breadwinner, they were in trouble. So there's the two distinctions I would put that at.
Although the one thing I have noticed in talking to a lot of child stars is that a lot of them seem to gravitate to behind the camera as adults. And the other thing, too, is, and this one kind of surprised me, as much as they enjoyed and loved everything they did as a child to get them where they are today, mm-hmm. most of them didn't want their kids to do the same thing.
They didn't. They didn't. It's not that they're so much bitter about it, but they don't want them to go through the experience of missing their childhood. I think that's the main factor. They were taken out of high school, and sometimes afterwards, or after their popularity, put back into school in the public school system, and some of them got bullied, and it took away for a lot. And I think as child stars became parents, they said, "Do I really want my kid to do that?" And decided not to. So I found that to be true.
Share with us some of the interesting people you talked to for Shooting the Breeze with Baby Boomer Stars. Who are some of your favorites?
Oh, my. I think Mark Medcalf from Animal House was one of those who I became friends with a little bit and talked to. I think Sherry Jackson and I became friends, and we talked to each other for quite a long time afterwards.
And for those who don't know, Mark played Niedermeyer in Animal House, right?
Right. I should put that down. Yes, I should say that. I've had dinner with many of them because I go to the Hollywood shows. I became friendly with Pat Priest, who was the blonde in the Eddie Munster, the Munster show.
Oh, Marilyn, the second Marilyn.
Yeah, the second Marilyn, exactly. And there's a whole story there, as you know well know. I also became a little bit close with Paul Peterson, and he is the standout child star. He's the poster boy because he has an organization, as you know, called A Minor Consideration, which collected money and puts it out for helping child stars of today and yesteryear. He had a friend from the Danny Thomas show, Rusty Hamer, who committed suicide back in Louisiana, and he decided, this isn't fair. I got to help some of these people. So he's an interesting and a leader of child stars, and I got to know him quite well. There's some other standout ones. I was really excited to interview Billy Gray. He's quite old, and Billy Gray was on Father Knows Best, and he was in the classic science fiction, The Day the Earth Stood Still, as a little boy who taught the spaceman what America was all about. And you've got to see that movie, of course, if you've never seen it. And I got to meet him in person, too, and talk to him. So there's quite a few of them that stand out. I've interviewed about 150 to 175 celebrities. Not all of them, of course, are in my book. I only put 50 in my book. So each one is different. You could put them in categories, but they're just like plumbers or people who are like policemen. I mean, they all have different personalities and grew up and went out in different areas.
And were most of them child stars, or did you have a lot of them that were adult stars at the time that they were most popular?
Some of them, I categorized, and the way I chose people to interview is how they had an effect on the baby boomer generation. So many of them were child stars, like Lyle Waggoner. He was around the Carol Burnett show, real handsome guy, played the, you know, macho guy, and was in Wonder Woman, but he wasn't a child star at all. He just had a normal childhood. And then all of a sudden he disappeared and never really made big money. And the shocking thing is he made a fortune with the dressing rooms, the mobile dressing rooms. He one time was on a remote location, and he said to the producer, "Hey, you know what? What if I bought one of these? Would you rent it for me for $350 a week?" And the guy says, "Yeah, sure." He says, "Where do you get these?" "Oh, different places." Well, to make a very long story short, he's got a company which almost every dressing room that's mobile now is purchased from Lyle Waggoner's company, and his son runs it. And he's a multimillionaire. So started with that one little one from the Wonder Woman set. So, there's a lot of people who have a image from the baby boomer generation, but weren't child stars. Just so many of them made it later in their midlife and were character actors, great character actors. A guy named George Weiner, W-Y-N-E-R, Google his name.
Yep.
Not a familiar face. I mean, not a familiar name, but as soon as you see his face, oh, my God, he's been in everything.
He's been in absolutely everything, yeah.
Yeah, 200 TV episodes. He was in Spaceballs. I mean, he's just very funny, very, very dry humor, funny type of guy. Just a great guy.
And in that same vein, someone who grew up as a child star and has an amazing career as an adult in a lot of things, Barry Livingston.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Barry and I talk on the phone quite a bit, everybody, and I've been out to dinner with Barry, and I'm not going to give away. I have a little surprise thing that Nixon called him one day, and I'll leave it to the book. I want people to buy the book, of course. there's quite a few familiar names, but until you see their face, you say, oh, yeah, now I know who they are. So... a lot of them were from Disney, and a lot of Disney used a lot of kid actors in movies, like Tommy Kirk, who wasn't a Mouseketeer, but did a lot of film, Flubber, and all these type of Disney, and he was an Old Yeller, and he kind of had a tragic kind of career afterwards, and he was one of those on the opposite side that did have troubles and didn't make it in show business later on. So,
the book is called Shooting the Breeze with Baby Boomer Stars. You also, as I mentioned, have a radio show. We've got just about a minute. Tell us about the radio show you do.
It's a podcast, and it's on iHeartRadio, and all my interviews are on there. And if you go to iHeart and go to Baby Boomers Talk Radio, I will come up. If you Google my name, Torchy Smith, I'm the only one that comes up, and a lot of information about myself, and other than Torchy's Tacos, I'm not Torchy's Tacos, it's Torchy Smith, and I have a website, www.babyboomerstalkradio.
Torchy, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Oh, great, great, I appreciate it. Peter Anthony Holder, three names there, I got to get them all in. Thank you, Peter.
Torchy Smith, author of Shooting the Breeze with Baby Boomer Stars. You can go to my website at thestumpfile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0499, and you'll find links to Torchy's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. I've got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you before we get to our idiot of the day, okay? So here we go. A driver caught speeding in Western Germany got himself into even deeper water when police found his license contained an impossible date. Police pulled over the 56-year-old driver during speed checks in Dortmund, whereupon he showed officers a Polish license containing the date August 32nd, 2017. In a statement, police said that because the date doesn't exist, even in the Polish calendar, officers did a bit more research. They found the car he was driving had been decommissioned months ago. Police seized the car and the cleverly forged driving license. The man now faces prosecution for suspected forgery. You know, this guy might have been more successful if he had put February 30th on his license. Not exactly the sharpest tool in the shed here, is he? Yeah. You know, I was thinking for a split second maybe he could be the idiot of the day, but no. I thought I'd put him perhaps idiot adjacent, which means this next story, boys and girls, is the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the idiot of the day.
The old adage of, if I can't have it, you can't have it, might come into play here. A man is accused of throwing several Molotov cocktails over a fence, striking his own impounded car. Authorities say Ayub Abdul Rahman went to All Makes Auto Sales in Orange County, Florida, at around 2:30 p.m. to pay for towing fees on his Nissan Altima. According to the arrest documents, the owner of the shop, Darnell Adams, told Ayub that he would meet him at the lot shortly to get his car. When Adams got to the lot, he told deputies Ayub was not there, so he left to go and get the keys to the car. According to deputies, when Adams returned to the shop, he saw Ayub running away. Adams looked at the shop surveillance video and saw Ayub throw four Molotov cocktails over the fence and onto his Altima. Adams was able to put the fire out with an extinguisher before firefighters arrived, telling deputies he wished to press charges. The fire started getting pretty high with the flames and all, and I could have lost a lot, you know. I worked hard to get this, and I'm glad nothing else happened, and I'm glad they were able to catch him and put him where he needs to be, Adams said. Authorities are unsure why Ayub decided to set his own car on fire. Adams said that if he had just waited 20 minutes, Ayub would have been able to drive out, since Adams had left to get the keys for him. Ayub was arrested and charged with arson and possessing, manufacturing, and transporting a firebomb. Okay, this time around, I got a couple of questions. Before we get to the why, oh why, would you want to firebomb your own vehicle, we have to ask the simple question of, why would you just happen to have four Molotov cocktails ready to go when you're coming to pay for and pick up your impounded car? Alas, the answer to both questions is, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0499. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0499. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.